Mr. Pittner.
It's really not that interesting to your office. Now, wait till you
see. And please support. My name is Nicholas Pittner. I'm one of the attorneys of Plaintiff Appellant in this case. With the counsel table are attorneys Sue Johnson, John Barrett, and Susan Greenberg.
We've had a request that large board be put down on the floor. We know what that provision of the Constitution is, and so you can just put it down on the floor. Who's that?
Okay. That is our chair.
I think we can all still see it. Of course, we have it well in our mind. Thank you. Mr. Pittner, you may proceed.
We'd like to reserve, if we may, 5 minutes of our time for all your honors. Your honors, this case is about responsibility. It's about the responsibility of the General Assembly of the State of Ohio to carry out the mandate of Article 6, Section 2 of the Ohio Constitution. It's also about the responsibility of this court to recognize that they have a time and make a guilty. It isn't about encroaching into the legislative prerogative. We understand that legislatures create school funding systems. That's their job. We're not asking you to do their job. We're asking you to do your job. It's not about sitting as a super school board. We have a state bureaucracy, a state board of education. We have school boards to make local decisions. We're not asking this court to make local decisions.
Let me ask you what is maybe one of the fundamental questions you'll be receiving. In your brief, you mentioned that Walter was a case involving school funding, and that this is a case that challenges the way in which Ohio educates its children. Is that really what this case is about?
Yes, it is.
Or it's not confined to funding? I wanted to make sure I'm focused on the issue as you see it.
In this case, it is not decided by Walter.
I understand your argument on that. But.
Yes, there are three reasons why we believe that to be so. First of all, it's a different funding system. The funding system that was challenged in Walker was newly enacted in 1966. It provided for equal yield.
Counsel, we know Walter. There are going to be a lot of questions in a limited amount of time. If nobody else is going to interrupt you at this point, I guess I will. And just to ask you I want you to take us to the end of this procedure, if you would. You've indicated this is about responsibility and all of that. If we're persuaded by your arguments and your brief and the extensive findings of fact, most of which were stipulated. Where does that all end up? I read the trial court's conclusions and retained limited jurisdiction. So if you win, what's the bottom line at the end of the day? Take us out in 4 or 5 years. If you prevail today, if you persuade us that you should win, what's the result?
The result, Your Honor, is first of all, there are three ways to win this case. Number one, guard efficiency is violated. Number two, equal protection is violated, either by the rational basis test or the fundamental rights.
I'm sure we'll be back to that, but I'm asking you to skip ahead because that. You have some persuasive arguments, but what's the result? If you prevail,
the result that we believe would be appropriate here is consistent with the results of other state high courts, which have held that education is a fundamental right. What they have done is directed the General Assemblies of their states to develop those components of a thorough efficient system of public education. The Wyoming Supreme Court did it most recently and did it best. They said to their General Assembly, you must determine a basket of educational services that represent two things. Number one, that which is necessary to enable our children to be responsible citizens and economically productive. And secondly, that which our state's education agency says is necessary for an adequate education. Once you've defined that basket, then you send it to the General Assembly and say, all right, you provide it to the youth of our state, all of them, on a substantially equal basis, recognizing that there are needs.
If I could interject, since you've mentioned the word equal basis, to have a thorough and efficient common school system, is it necessary for it to be equal, or are we just talking about a high-quality education?
We're talking about a level playing field of opportunity, Your Honor. We believe a high-quality education is what the legislature's obligation already is. It's not happening on an equal basis. We don't have a level playing field.
Excuse me, are you saying that under the present system in Ohio, we have a high-quality education in all of the school districts?
No, we do. We certainly do not, Your Honor. We have a statute that says there should be a high quality of education, but the reality of it is that isn't happening. To return to your question, Justice Piper, I believe that the General Assembly of the State of Ohio is totally capable of creating a funding system that provides a level playing field of opportunity for our children, recognizing that the children in Dawson Bryant are no less citizens of this state than the children in Beechwood.
How precise, the trial judge seemed to leave this open, said to the state board, go come up with a plan and submit it to the legislature. What is it that you're asking us to do? Simply affirm that from the trial court, and does that mean that you're not asking us to make some determination as to what minimum education costs, those kinds of things?
We're certainly not asking this court to determine what minimum education costs are. In fact, one of the reasons we're here is because the General Assembly doesn't know how much minimum education costs.
So what is it that you're asking us ultimately to do?
To reverse the Court of Appeals from the decision of the trial court, which gave guidance, or if this court wants to give its own guidance. Part of the reason we're here is because there is no clear message to the General Assembly that a substantially equal basic educational opportunity is a right of Ohio's children.
You say that we direct the General Assembly, and for instance, as Wyoming, and say things like children ought to have such an education that they will be responsible citizens, or some language like that. How is that going to be any more directed to a General Assembly than thorough and efficient?
Simply to say, Your Honor, to the General Assembly, that their obligation is to provide a thorough and efficient system, and that's a fundamental right for Ohio's children, is enough. You need to say no more than that.
Fundamental right. I want to explore that with you for a minute, because in the brief you say that does not necessitate equality. I think the words were, we're not saying it has to be equal, right?
That's correct.
And then, but if you follow through logically the components of the determination of a fundamental right, that requires that the court, under a constitutional analysis, applies strict scrutiny. So that, agreed? And once we apply strict scrutiny to every educational decision, it requires that any disparity between two classifications be supported by some compelling state interest, right?
That's correct.
And so if you're not seeking equality, and yet we'll have to find a compelling state interest, I'm interested in what do you envision as a sufficient compelling state interest to permit any disparity?
First of all, Your Honor, not every educational, not everything a school does necessarily is subject to strict scrutiny.
If it's a fundamental right, and people can challenge every classification, can't they?
The right to a basic education is a fundamental right, not every component of that education. Some school districts can offer things far above or different from the basic level of educational opportunity that is issued, that issue here, and we're not suggesting that those are subject to strict scrutiny analysis.
But does the court have to find the fundamental right in order for it to be thorough and efficient?
No, they're entirely...
Yeah, the court can find that it is not a fundamental right and still come up with a solution that the present system that we have now is not thorough and efficient as the Constitution says it must be. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor, absolutely. And in fact, the trial court in this case chronicled a number of circumstances.
But the trial court found a fundamental right, though.
It also found that the current education system does not meet the standards of the thorough and efficient requirement of the Ohio Constitution, Your Honor.
But one does not equate to the other must follow.
No. The two can be independent tests.
If we proceed under this clause, under thorough and efficient, then we don't really have to address whether education is a fundamental right.
You don't have to for this case, Your Honor. I believe you do have to for the next case. Because the people across the street, the people who are ultimately responsible to fix it, need to have a clear message. The message needs to be that children should not have to go to school in buildings that are crumbling, that are beset with friable asbestos, to play on playgrounds fouled with raw sewage, to have water with arsenic in it, to have to participate in lotteries for textbooks, to go to classes and convert programs.
Those kinds of things that you're mentioning trouble me because nobody would disagree that is not, you know, that's not good. That is not good at all. But when we deal with constitutional law, we have to deal with constitutional standards. And what particularly troubles me about the argument being made is that it seems to me this is a fluid kind of standard. What is appropriate and thorough and efficient under today's budget? I mean, what we have from the plaintiffs and as evidence is expert testimony about how much basic education costs in Ohio, a problem with basic education. That's changing. That'll change every budget. How is something so fluid subject to a constitutional standard?
Your Honor, if I might offer a comparison, the courts, for example, have recognized that a right of a convicted prisoner to be free from cruel and unusual punishment and conditions of confinement is a fundamental right. I would suggest, Your Honor, that the state of Ohio today could not lawfully incarcerate a convicted felon in some of the very buildings that we today send our children to school. We recognize that there is a right to vote, that is a fundamental right, but at the same time, we realize electoral districts are not drawn with mathematical precision. We recognize that the observance of rights that are basic to our way of life are not always going to be the same. And as you've recognized, Your Honor, the Constitution is a living document. It's intended to change. And conditions that might meet the standard today may not meet the standard tomorrow. And that is why we believe that it should be the obligation of the state of Ohio to undertake and fulfill its burden, and that whether or not it's been done clearly is an appropriate matter for review by this court. I don't know where the bright line is, Your Honor. I do know that the current funding system is on the wrong side of it. It will always be a continuum because what was thorough and efficient in 1851 would not be today.
And what was thorough and efficient in 1979, Walter?
Is not today.
And if we rule today that 4,000 or whatever, what about, do we do it every, what how
no.
every other,
no. No,
every
no.
other biennium?
I believe this court, and I assume and I believe this court is entitled to assume that the General Assembly is fully capable of carrying out its constitutional obligations once they are told that, in fact, it is a constitutional obligation. What they need is for this court to tell them so. That's what is lacking in this case. And unless and until that occurs, there will not be a remedy.
I'm going to prevent you from getting into your notes again, Mr. Pittner. The trial court, as you know, ordered the superintendent instruction to eliminate wealth-based disparities among school districts, and we have a lot of talk at your brief about equal access, equal opportunity to education. One of the amicus briefs, I was interested in the suggestion of the amicus briefs that whatever we do, don't bring down the level of education in the districts that are able, by taxing themselves more, to afford to provide the extras, so-called extras that some people think of, others don't. It seems to me the trial court is not saying that. The trial court seems to me is saying that the education has to really be equal. Is that your view, or are you really arguing for, on behalf of Superintendent Sanders' argument that, or his statement that the $4,000 per pupil funding level at the state is what is really what's necessary? Would that do it? I assume it would not, right?
No, it wouldn't, Your Honor. But to respond to your question, I don't read the trial court as saying there must be an absolute equality of either program or dollars. I think the trial court recognized, as was clear on the record, the children will have different needs depending on their conditions, whether they're handicapped, whether they live in high concentrations of poverty. And there may be children with far greater needs than in some places than in others. So an absolute equality of dollars certainly doesn't meet the standard. Nor do you meet the standard with an absolute sameness of program from place to place, because again, children have different needs. What I believe that the trial court mandated and what we ask this court to agree with is the belief that all of Ohio's children should have a level playing field, a basic level of opportunity.
Well, that sounds great, and we all agree with that, but what does level playing field mean from a constitutional standpoint? Does that just simply mean that the state provides a higher amount of money, a greater amount of money for districts so that the poor districts receive more state aid? Is that the level playing field, or is there something more to it than that?
Well, I think there's more to it. Certainly, Your Honor, how much it costs is something that the folks across the street really need to determine because they haven't done it. But in terms of, is it going to cost more? Certainly it's going to cost more. There's no question about it. But simply saying, put more money into it and it's going to be okay, is not the answer either. And because...
Well, but then that takes us back to my first question about the challenges to the way in which Ohio educates its children. Are you asking the Supreme Court to tell the General Assembly to tell someone how to educate our children? We all have ideas about that, but is that our role? I mean, that's a pretty broad, seems to be a pretty broad responsibility for us.
Your Honor, we have a State Board of Education that has determined state minimum standards, which the plaintiffs are unable to meet. Now, maybe those state minimum standards are enough for our children into the year 2000. The State Board has said they're not enough. The system is wrong. It's morally wrong, as they characterize it, and that the funding is not sufficient to provide even the minimums today. So clearly, we have a monetary problem. But beyond the monetary problem, we have the issue of the need for this court to recognize that education is, in fact, part of the Ohio Constitution. It is a right of our children, and that it is a right, at least as to the basic common level of access to that education, that all of them share equally. Simply dollars won't do it, John.
Let me ask you another question that I think we need to resolve among the courts, and need to resolve, and that is that, as you know, the transcript, the record in this case, was created in 1991, I believe, and since then the General Assembly has changed, the basic level of funding is up, as you know, and there are a lot, by amicus brief we know, there are a lot of programs that are now in place that arguably help the poor districts, directed at helping them in ways that they were not assisted before. To what extent should we consider, that's all in our traditional sense of when we look at appeals, review appeals, we look at the record only. A lot of this is outside the record, unless it's obvious it's public knowledge, it's not something that we have to look very far to find. To what extent should we consider the progress that, well, the changes that have been made by the General Assembly since the transcript in this record in this case was created?
Your Honor, first of all, yes, there have been changes. Every session of the General Assembly in my 25 years of practicing law has changed education law in some fashion. The changes, however, have not changed the basic system. What they have done is put band-aids on a bleeding victim here. They haven't fixed it. What has been happened here is in operating funds, approximately 1% of increase has been provided, approximately 1% per year. In terms of facilities money, money to assist 26 of 611 districts, and only with building problems, not maintenance, not textbooks, not supplies, the General Assembly says we'll give you computers, and at the same time, their own offices say 52% of the schools in the state of Ohio aren't ready for computers. They don't even have wiring to plug them in. So if the court is saying they've changed something and therefore our job is made easier because now it's fixed, I think the answer is clearly no, it isn't fixed.
You mentioned wiring for the computers. Is that going to also bring about a problem with the asbestos when they go in to put wiring? Is that going to bring in that problem?
Well, it certainly will, Your Honor. When we have 80%, nearly 80% of our schools that the state has determined has asbestos hazards that need to be removed, and there is no money to remove asbestos. There's no money for textbooks. Our children participate in a lottery for textbooks because there are no funds.
I want to bring you back to, we haven't talked much about constitutional law here, but I want to bring you back to where I started out with you. There's a stipulation in this case that $4,000 per pupil is just bare bones minimum. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. In fact, there's not. There was reference in the Court of Appeals opinion to such a stipulation.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, there never was. And
so that's an error in the Court of Appeals.
The Court of Appeals reference is indicative of the fact that they didn't look at the record in this case and didn't really understand what was before them. There was never any such stipulation.
Okay, so there is nothing that there's no evidence in the case as to what the bare bones cost of a minimum level thorough education would cost in the state of Ohio.
That is correct, Your Honor. There is no evidence of that. In fact, the evidence said the state of Ohio doesn't know. The Department of Education doesn't know. Education is funded based on what's left over,
okay, but
budgetary residual.
You were the plaintiffs and you didn't offer any evidence on that either.
No, we didn't, Your Honor. The case was tried based on basically the issue of liability. The trial court, by pretrial rulings, said issues of remedy are not to be heard, and we stuck to that. We presented the system as it was.
So what you're really looking for is just a declaration that what the General Assembly is doing now fails to meet the constitutional standard.
That would suffice, Your Honor.
And nothing more. No retention of jurisdiction, none of those things.
You need not retain jurisdiction when the court does not wish to do so.
How do we, as long as we're asking questions, don't worry about the red light. How do we know without that information in the record to which Justice Piper just referred, how do we account for the way in which the state funds, and again, looking at the thorough and efficient, how do we account for the way in which the state funds are spent and used by local school districts? We know, of course, that there are at least one school district now under control of the State Board of Education. Nobody talked much about this in the briefs. I don't know if it's an issue that you don't think is relevant. If it isn't, tell me. Or if it's one that you can't get your arms around or you think it's too sensitive to talk about. But it seems to me that nobody mentions how much money it takes to provide a thorough and efficient education And then no one mentions how some districts spend funds wisely and the fact that some districts don't spend money wisely. How do we, I mean, we're talking about giving direction to the General Assembly and telling them to do something when I'm not convinced we know exactly what it is we're supposed to tell them to do except abide by the Constitution, which is easy.
We are, if I may, I think the analysis of that issue begins with the point that it is a state system. Local school districts are means by which the state has chosen to carry out its obligation. This isn't a partnership. This is a master-servant relationship. They are regulated by the state, massively regulated in every sense except providing an equity of dollars. So it is a state system. There's no evidence in the record of this case, absolutely none, that any local school district has mismanaged its funds. But even if they had, to be theoretical, isn't it the state's responsibility because they are agencies of the state of Ohio? And clearly it is. Now,
and that's
I don't
evidence.
Believe there's mismanagement here. What we have are school districts, by and large, that are terribly squeezed between rising expenses from the some 30 or so specific unfunded state mandates that the trial court found and its finding and static revenues resulting from House Bill 920. 52 cents of every dollar that goes into education right now is based on property taxes, and property tax dollars don't grow. House Bill 920 cost school districts $1.4 billion in fiscal year 1993 in monies that they otherwise would have had. It is the squeeze between rising costs, mandated costs, and limited dollars that is causing the impoverishment of our children. The victims are the children, and they're the children in places where there's no property value to tax, and people with low incomes have no money to pay the taxes, Your Honor. To say that the effort by these people, as was shown by in the record and determined by the trial court, is as great or greater. They spend as much or more of their resources to fund their education as do the more wealthy. The resources simply aren't there. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I find it astonishing that the General Assembly has not chosen to determine what is the average cost of a quality education. Do you have any explanation why they haven't at least taken that step so we know?
Well, Your Honor, I would point the court to the fact that among the budgetary considerations, we understand there are many. The education of our children so far is the only one that the courts have not recognized as having a degree of constitutional entitlement. I am, like you, astonished that they have done
it. Counsel, I want to come back, I guess, to what is in the record. You have a tremendous amount of information in the record about the conditions under which children are being educated in various school districts, test results, and a variety of things. You've indicated nothing in the record to give us a threshold to measure how many children are being provided an education that just doesn't make it because the dollars, the minimum dollars aren't there. But you do have the other issue, which is one that's been a longstanding interest to me, and that is the disparity. And we took you away from that issue and the discussion of that. As I read the briefs, that disparity has narrowed some from what it was 17 years ago and is now, what, 3.5 times or something like that between the property rich and the property poor school districts. Is that roughly correct?
No, Your Honor. In fact, the disparity is worse. The state's conceded that the disparity is worse. At the time of trial, Ohio was third worst in the nation. In the extent of
what's the expanse between the bottom and the top?
In the wealthy school districts today, children receive as much as $12,000 or more per pupil, and this is at the time of trial. In poor school districts, children were receiving as little as $3,300 per pupil. There were classrooms. This disparity carried into a classroom would show that there were some classrooms receiving as much as $200,000 per year more because of no reason other than the school district in which those children happen to reside.
Okay, is there a mathematical number that you can throw at us that you'd say, well, the General Assembly is beginning to get there in terms of this disparity? I believe in your brief you're not arguing that you have to go like legislative redistricting and get down to the last person, in this case the last dollar. Is there something, some formula that you would indicate to what we think that begins to meet constitutional muster?
If I may, I don't have a formula for you because I believe the first step in that analysis is to determine what it costs to provide a basic educational opportunity for our children. And only once that determination has been made can we start putting numbers on it. That's why I don't have numbers for this court, and I don't believe the court needs to have numbers in order to find in favor of the plaintiffs, because it is very clear that what we have here is wrong. If I may take the court back, and what I would want to say here is that we need to go back and look at why that clause is there. Our founders recognized that education was necessary not only for our children, but for our state. It is not just a good for them, not just a benefit that they enjoy, it's an essential benefit for the continuation of our form of government. Without it, we will not only pay the costs of prisons and social programs, which we are now paying dearly as the entitled part of the state budget, but beyond that, our system of government simply cannot survive. That's why it's there. And in order to observe it, this court need only recognize it and affirm the decision of the trial court, reversing the court of appeals.
Counselor, just before you sit down, I was not going to engage in this question, but we ought to straighten out the record before us. We have enough trouble with the rest of the record. It has been asserted here, and I found it curious that you seem to agree that there was no basic figure in the record with regard to what it would cost to educate a child in each school district. I reviewed the testimony of Senator Alan Kasich, who at the time was the president. At the time of the trial was the president of the state school board. He very clearly said that the board took the position that it was at least $4,000. That's in the record, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And why would you say there wasn't anything in the record?
Well, that was the state board's position in 1992, Your Honor.
But there was
roughly $4,000 would do it.
I understand that. If we're going to take into consideration what the General Assembly has done and what that commission that the trial judge ordered came up with and the budget was presented, they're all different figures. But you've taken the position there isn't anything in the record with regard to what it costs. And Alvaro Casey did testify to that, didn't he?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. I appreciate you reminding me of that. In terms of the court's concern, I believe this case needs to be decided on the record. There's not been a fix. The circumstances before the court today are basically the same circumstances that Judge Lewis saw in Perry County on July 1st, 1994. And that's what needs to be decided.
Counsel, in view of that, and I guess I stopped in where I was going with that question because I thought that was in the record also, the $4,000 number. The question that I wanted to follow that with is there anything in the record establishing how many school children in the state at that time, I realize that's a 1992 number, how many children were being educated weren't receiving that amount of dollars in support for their education. We've got, what, 1.6, 1.8 million?
1.8 million, Your Honor.
School children, how many of the 1.8 didn't rise to that level of support at that time?
I am hazarding a guess, Your Honor, but I believe that the average per pupil expenditure at that time was less than $4,000. So I think we can fairly say that half of Ohio students were not receiving that amount of funding. I believe the the record would support that conclusion.
There's nothing specific in the record to that point.
There is information on the record.
Yeah, I have a printout. I have a printout in front of me from the Department of Education. It shows that the statewide average in 91 was $4,585.
Okay, and so that being the average, half would be approximately below.
Yeah.
Yes.
And there is information in the record what the calculation under the formula was in 92 and 93. Something like $2,817.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Pittner.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Sutton.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. My name is Jeff Sutton. I'm the State Solicitor for Attorney General Betty Montgomery. At the outset, I want to clarify what the actual, as opposed to the apparent, lines of disagreement are between the plaintiff on one side and the state on the other. It is not now, and never has been, the state's position in this case that we are seeking this court's judicial stamp of approval on the current educational status quo. The reason is twofold. One, I don't think there is such a thing as the educational status quo. By its very nature, education policy, spending, and taxing decisions are always changing. It's always a moving target. The second reason is that the system isn't perfect. It does contain flaws, and there are things we need to do better as a state. The question in this case is this. The question is, who is going to take us from today's point A to tomorrow's point B? The plaintiff's position on that score is no more accurately summarized than their own mission statement. What the coalition says is that additional school funding must not be left solely the legislative process or, and I quote, the will of the voters. We disagree fundamentally.
Where's that in the record?
1476 is the supplement. It's volume 5 of the supplement. This is the coalition's mission statement, volume 5.
Well, counsel, let me get to something that troubled me in Judge Reeder's concurring opinion. He suggested this is a sham lawsuit. Are we dealing with a real controversy between litigants with different points of view, or was this thing a sham at the trial?
Well, I disagree entirely with the statement that this is a sham, and if what you mean to say is that there's not actually a case or controversy. In other words, we just don't disagree.
No, he suggested that everything was stipulated, and the state board and the local school districts were all wanted the same end result.
Well, I'm in complete sympathy with the state board's position on many issues. I'm in complete sympathy with the school districts in this case.
Okay, but there is a real controversy here being litigated.
Absolutely, and that's exactly where I was going with their mission statement. The question here is whether we're going to look to the will of the voters and their elected representatives, whether they're at the state level or at the local school board level, to address these problems. And that, Justice Piper, is the controversy.
Let me take it to a... You make a constitutional argument. I mean, they make an argument about the conditions falling below the standards, and you're making a constitutional argument to the people. You're representing whom in this case?
We represent the state of Ohio, the state board, and the state department, and the superintendent.
Now, a key issue is whether or not education is a key constitutional issue, is whether or not this education is a fundamental right.
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
Okay. Is it the position of the State Board of Education that education is not a fundamental right?
Your Honor, with respect to the question of what the State Board thinks is a matter of policy, as a matter of policy, I think they do think it's a fundamental right. And with respect to the question of what their lawyers think, what the state attorney general thinks, which is their only representative when it comes to a case of controversy in this court, it is not a fundamental right.
Okay, so the state board has never taken a position spread upon their minutes to find that education is not a fundamental right.
I think, to be perfectly candid about it, that's not true. They do think it's a fundamental right. Again, it's a policy matter.
Okay. What about state superintendent?
The state, with respect to each and every one of them, there are two questions. Question one is what an individual litigant thinks something is as a policy matter. Question two is what their attorneys think something
okay,
is.
Well,
they can't appear in court through their attorneys.
We've got to determine whether or not the Constitution has been violated. So, would it be your statement that the state superintendent believes that education is a fundamental right?
The current state superintendent, of course, did not testify during trials as superintendent. I think the former superintendent did indicate that his opinion, his personal opinion, thought it was a fundamental right.
The State Department itself, that's a separate defense, right?
Yes.
Okay. What's their position on the issue?
The same.
That it is a fundamental right. Did the General Assembly ever make an expression of whether or not this is a fundamental right?
The General Assembly was not sued in this case, Your Honor.
How about the governor? Was he sued?
No. The state of Ohio was the last defendant.
And that's where the Attorney General comes in. So,
the Attorney General represents all four.
Right.
And the Attorney General, with respect to the state of Ohio, makes the determination as a legal matter what her position is going to be on this constitutional question.
Okay. Has the governor taken a position as to whether or not it is a fundamental right?
My understanding in this case is that the governor has filed an amicus brief and has taken a position that as a constitutional matter, it's not a fundamental right. But let me keep in mind, Justice Piper, because I want to be honest to respond to your questions. It's one thing to call something a fundamental right. It's another thing to suffer from the consequences of that label. While we do have testimony from certain state employees that in their opinion education is a fundamental right, I have yet to hear one piece of testimony with respect to their view that all education decisions should be subject to strict scrutiny. In other words, that this court and the lower court should be second-guessing, looking over the shoulders of all of their policy-making decisions. And that, of course, gets right to the heart of the matter as to why it's a constitutional matter. It is not a fundamental right. It never has been.
Mr. Stetton, if we proceed under the Education Clause, do we have to determine whether education is a fundamental right?
No, you do not. And of course, the pre-existing precedent in Walter does decide that question, so it does not need to be addressed at all.
I don't think Walden decided that question. I just think that Walden said they didn't like the Rodriguez test. Justice Walker, in his dissent, goes into a long dissertation about fundamental rights. But Justice Phil Brown, the majority opinion, didn't really take a stand on that. And I don't think Walden decided that issue at all.
Well, first of all, Justice Sweeney, Justice Walker dissented for the very reason that the court did not find it to be a fundamental right. The six-member majority that overruled the Court of Appeals overruled a decision that had found that education was a fundamental right. But there's a more fundamental issue here, and it goes to the court's analysis.
Well, does everybody agree that there is a problem? I take it from reading all the vast material that we've had, but really everybody's in agreement with the statements of fact and the findings of the fact of the trial court. Is that correct?
Well, there are some 400 pages in that opinion. I would say that many of them are disputed in fact.
Well, it's almost a stipulated record, is it not?
No, I wouldn't say that.
What did you object to in the findings of fact of the trial court?
Well, Your Honor, one fundamental flaw with the trial court decision, the 480-page decision, is that the trial court misapprehended the constitutional issues. Once that happened, that infected many of the trial court findings of fact. It really makes it perfectly clear, Justice Sweeney. We embrace many of the findings of fact.
I was going to say, do you mean that there are many disagreements, page after page after page, that you disagree with the findings of fact?
No, I don't at all.
There are none.
In fact, they don't judge me either. And the findings of fact show that things have improved since Walter.
In fact, everybody agreed to the finding of the trial court, and the case wasn't even going to be appealed.
No, that's a mistake. The state board did not want to appeal a trial court decision. And let's be candid and fair and exercise some common sense with respect to this issue.
Well,
the same board,
the same problems that that were in Walder, 1979, are the same problems today, but magnified. Now, if those same problems are still with us, who is to decide how to fix those problems? Whose obligation is it to fix those problems?
Justice Smith, I want to answer that question. I do want to say, because you focused on the trial court findings of fact, they do indicate that conditions improved by every measure, whether it's per pupil spend, equity, total expenditures, the percentage of the state budget. So that's there. I mean, look at page 102 to 104, then look at 85 to 102 of the trial court's opinion. But I want to get what is your real question. It's a common sense question that gets to the heart of this case. And I'm going to make it even harder on myself to answer. But let's talk about what is perhaps their best equitable argument. They talk about the southern local schools. I says,
no, let's answer my question. My question was, everybody realizes there's a problem, but no one even wants to solve it. Now, whose obligation is it to solve it?
Ultimately, it's up to the voters of the state and our elected representatives to solve this problem.
The legislature.
And local school boards. And local school boards.
The legislature does not cure the problems. Who then is to cure the problem?
Well, the question is, what is the definition of a problem? If a problem means...
The problem we have in this case.
Your Honor, let me grant you a premise. Let's assume that as soon as an individual litigant can identify a problem in one of the 3,600 school buildings in the state, that the state is responsible on the spot for remedying the problem, we've got a real problem on our hands. And the reason we have a real problem on our hands, Justice Sweeney, is we're going to completely sack local initiative when it comes to raising money and getting involved local decision-making and correcting these very problems in this case. The example I want to give you, and I'm not trying to avoid your question, I think it supports what you're saying. They argue in their reply that Southern Local had an elementary school where plaster was falling in kids' heads. There were asbestos laid in place. There were too many classrooms close together. There were problems in that school system. I agree entirely. The question here, is what do? You say in 1980, as soon as that problem was raised, that the state suddenly has to come in and build a new school building. The Constitution just doesn't make that value judgment. And I don't think we want to say it does make that value judgment, because if we do, what incentive will there ever be for the next local levy, whether it's millage or the next levy on a bond?
Well, there's nothing in the state fund that says they have to fix any road. There's no building in that fund provision.
Just between there's the Constitution or in the statutes?
No, it's how the legislature is following through with this problem.
No, there is. Back in 1980, there was the Classroom Facilities Act. And what that does is it provides a set amount of money by the General Assembly to be used to help school districts like Southern Local build or repair a new building. And that amount of money has increased dramatically. But let me tell you, there's a stopping point.
If that amount of money has increased dramatically, why will it take $10.2 billion to bring the schools up to standard?
And Justice Reisman, the state cannot be accused of violating one constitutional provision while respecting another. Let me explain what I mean by that. Funding for new school buildings, that is the capital structures themselves, has always been handled at the local level until the 70s. Those buildings are as much the school districts as City Hall is or Little League Field. As you're well aware, Article 8 of the Ohio Constitution imposes debt limitations with respect to the General Assembly's ability to go into debt for future periods of time. As Governor Voinovich recognized, he tried to pass a $1 billion levy for this very purpose a couple years ago. We need a constitutional amendment to do that. The state can't simply raise $10 billion without a constitutional amendment. So it can't possibly be. The thorough and efficient clause requires us to violate another constitutional provision.
And we also, but isn't the state in fact violating a constitutional provision when it is requiring school districts to go into debt that they're in debt today, taking the Cuyahoga County School District is in debt, I think, $143 million. Isn't that really a state obligation?
I don't know the extent to which it's a state constitutional obligation. I will say this. The General Assembly has risen to the occasion of, there are, I think the record shows that there are roughly 15 of the lowest spending districts are the ones that are most troubled by debt that have actually gone into debt. Two-thirds of that is with respect to Cleveland and Cincinnati school districts. It's worth pointing out that Cleveland and Cincinnati are the highest, up in the highest tier with respect to per pupil. I think Cleveland is 6,100 to 91.
What does the Constitution require?
With respect to the bankruptcy issue?
No, with respect to education.
What the Constitution requires with respect to the fair and efficient clause is that it's a backstop. It's a backstop to the legislative, local, and state process so that what the state does, what the state guarantees, is that every school district in the state has a sufficient amount of money to have the means to comply with state minimum standards. That's, of course, the test that was articulated in Walter. I think more generally, what it means and what Walter is saying is that you've got to provide a free basic education. That's what Miller versus Corn said. That's what the framers' debates suggest back in 1858.
Okay, and what plaintiffs are contending here is that the legislature isn't providing a free basic education.
I think that's exactly right. And I think their flaw is that they have to overrule Walter to get there, because the record evidence indicates that they did.
No, we have to overrule Walter to get there, and to
you're right. If it were that easy, we wouldn't be here.
But in Walter, quoting from Miller versus Corn, stated, a thorough system could not mean one in which part or any number of the school districts of the state were not starved for funds. An efficient system could not mean one in which part or any number of the school districts of the state lacked teachers, building, and equipment. How can you say that we would have to overrule Walter when they have adopted it and seem to be saying if the condition is as it exists in 1996, it's violating the Constitution?
Well, I guess Walter, of course, is a long opinion, and it does quote Miller versus Corn there. I think when they describe what they mean by that, they're talking about an absolute deprivation of an educational opportunity, that what you're entitled to is a free basic education, not free best education the state can provide. So
how do we determine what that is?
Well, first of all, I think Walter gives awfully useful advice.
Did you offer any evidence as to what the cost to the state is of a free basic education?
Of course, it's the defendant that the burden is on plaintiffs on that matter.
So they have this $4,000 number in there. They at least have that in the record.
That was not a study, Your Honor. That was a...
Well, it's some evidence. Okay, was that evidence controverted by some other number?
Your Honor, the evidence was controverted by quite a few other numbers, the most significant of which are that per pupil and total expenditures from the time of Walter to today, or to the time of trial, had increased dramatically. That, accounting for inflation, that by definition proves that we were better off today than we were in Walter, when there was already a significant spread.
That's a pretty weak argument, I think. That's all that we advance. Well, let me take back to it.
But Justice Piper, that criticism, is it possible for me to offer one other answer?
Sure.
Not to leave us
sure.
That. The other piece of evidence that we provided was the fact, and this is critical, and I hope we can explore this, that the local districts, with respect to finance, were spending more than the minimum state requirements in several areas. Now, those may well have been good policy decisions, but as the Walter case indicated, we can't very well have a standard that says you have complete discretion to spend as much as you want in one area, let's say teacher salaries or pupil-teacher ratios, and then effectively create a constitutional problem in another area. So that was critical evidence we relied on there. And I think the court is trying to think, as you were, Justice Piper, about where we're going, where plaintiffs are trying to take the court. I think it's those decisions that you need to keep in mind. Let's think of what happens to plaintiff school districts like this that truly are dealing with difficult circumstances. They have declining enrollment, okay, declining property values, and as a result, they get less state money. If we're looking just at the foundation formula. The question is, what does the school board do in that instance? Does the school board say, well, the fiscally responsible thing to do is to lay off some teachers until our enrollment comes up, and then perhaps buy some new textbooks to make sure we're up to date? That's not a bad policy decision. I don't think this court wants to, or the state for that matter, the General Assembly, wants to be involved in ensuring that every school district lays off a teacher as soon as there's a decline in enrollment, or that salaries don't rise too quickly to cause problems with respect to new textbooks or varsity sports or languages in the high school. And that, if we're trying to figure out what's really going on here, it's those difficult local decisions. What do you do when there's an economic dislocation?
But I thought it was a contention of the other side that the whole formula is out of whack, and that the formula is the problem, and that is something that the legislature has to fix. Isn't that what they're contending?
I think it is what they're contending.
Period. The type of taxation and system that is set up by the state isn't working. And they say a new type of formula needs to be found and implemented in place by the state in order to correct the problem. Nothing else will solve the problem. Is that their main contention?
Absolutely, Justice.
All right, and you disagree with that?
I do. Can I explain why?
Yes.
Of course, there's two main components to funding. One is the foundation formula that we're all aware of with respect to property taxes. And the second are the different forms of equity, categorical aid, DPIA, et cetera. The foundation, there is no more. I challenge the plaintiffs to come up with a more progressive form of property taxation than what this General Assembly has enacted and essentially follows since 1975-76. What it does is it says, regardless of how poor or how wealthy your property is in a given school district, you're guaranteed a set amount of money. This year it's $3,500. So that if you've got a school district that for one reason or another can only generate a few hundred, $400 per pupil in property tax revenue, the state kicks in the remaining $3,000. By contrast, if you're a wealthy school district and 20 mils, 23 mils of taxation gets you to $3,500, you don't get anything.
I mean, of course, they wish is that we no longer use the property tax system.
And that's exactly right, Justice Cook. I should note, and I'm surprised that Walter Ford didn't know this. As the court is well aware, the U.S. Supreme Court visited this very issue in 1973 in Rodriguez. And a decision by Justice Powell, who incidentally was the former head of the Virginia Board of Education and the Richmond Schools, they rejected that claim. In footnote 85 of that opinion, and it's a long opinion, regrettably, but if you look at footnote 85, you'll see that the sole remedy that the plaintiffs had advanced in that case, okay, plaintiffs lost. The sole remedy plaintiffs had advanced in that case was the one identified in footnote 85. Lo and behold, that is exactly what the General Assembly has done in this case. What footnote 85 describes is the very foundation formula I just described in responding to Justice Sweeney's question. But that's not all we have, Justice Sweeney. In addition to the foundation formula, we've got a whole slate of equitable appropriations that only go to the poor districts. And that's why the unequivocal evidence in the trial court's opinion indicated that from the time of Walter to the time of trial, per pupil spending with respect to the poorer districts had increased from 42% to 52%, whereas in the wealthy districts, it had only increased 16%.
Counsel, let me take you back to some constitutional issues and arguments. I want to give you a chance to talk about the end game also in this whole thing, so I'll get to that, but going back to what we have to decide is what is the constitutional mandate and what's the test that we apply. You argue that education is not a fundamental right in the view of the state of Ohio, even though the state board, the State Department of Education, state superintendent may view it as a
fundamental right, so strict scrutiny should not apply.
Right.
That means if you get under one prong of the Constitution, then it's a rational basis for what the legislature has done. Okay. Now, what evidence was put into this case that indicated the rational basis for the cost of business, cost of doing business formula?
The cost of doing business formula is quite rational, Your Honor. I should note,
was there some data that the General Assembly considered when it enacted that?
Well, the point I wanted to make, Your Honor, and this was not a point raised by counsel on the other side, so I did not cite this in my brief, but with respect to the rational basis test, you did not need to make a showing. You did not need to show, for example, in legislative history or through some other means, the General Assembly considered some factor in adopting legislation. Indeed, the very nature of the rational basis test is that we are allowed, the justices and the attorneys in the case, to consider what rational basis there might be for certain legislation.
Okay, well, there's a precise number from county to county to county.
Right.
Now, we're just supposed to presume that there was some empirical data that someone studied and that this was not a matter of log rolling as to how one county got to be a better percentage than another in terms of cost of doing business.
We are stuck with that, just as we're stuck with it when it comes to the general appropriations and figuring out whether $300 million or $310 million goes
to there's nothing in the record that indicates there was any empirical data backing that up.
I should know that, not to my knowledge.
Okay. What about the disadvantaged pupil? That's a big number in terms
Absolutely.
Of how this formula works.
Absolutely.
Was there any empirical data offered to indicate how that number is derived?
If I could answer it in two parts, not to my knowledge, again, but again, let me add that what DPIA money does is it accounts, or what it attempts to do, is account for the number of children in a given district that are effectively on welfare.
Yeah, but it's if you have 3% of your students are on welfare, you may get zero.
Exactly right. In other words, the higher the percentage, you're exactly right. Today it's capped at 1288.
So if you have a high percentage, then it's a high number per pupil.
Right.
It doesn't. It's not a formula that looks at it and says if
for every single one.
For every single disadvantaged pupil, we're going to give X dollar.
Well, then I think again, we have to guess. I mean, it's worth pointing out that people in Ohio that made this decision about the debate we're having, they don't allow for legislative history, so there's nothing we could do to provide that kind of information as opposed to try to indicate what the General Assembly had in mind.
But nothing was presented at the trial court level to indicate that there have been empirical studies that provide some
Had they tried to introduce it, I would have objected.
Okay.
It's irrelevant. Because there's no indication, given our understanding that we don't have legislative history.
And what about that school foundation floor, which you indicate is now $3,500?
Right.
Was there anything presented that indicated any kind of study or information that told the legislature that at a bare bones minimum, anywhere in the state of Ohio, you've got to have at least $3,500 to educate a child?
What you're getting at is there's no comparable study indicating that this is what the cost of the minimum standards, the absolute minimum education, there wasn't. I can assure you, a few of the other efforts would have been well below $3,500.
So what we're left with is this constitutional mandate and really no empirical data with which to compare when trying to decide whether the constitutional mandate has been met.
Well, Justice Claybor, I think your questions indicate the problem with their very argument. I can't understand a constitutional principle that would require the courts, and ultimately this court, to inquire as to every educational funding decision, whether each component was consistent with the most recent test. That would force the Department of Education, instead of focusing on meeting proficiency tests and dealing with some of the problems in the state, on constantly doing and redoing studies to figure out what the lowest
is. Let me let me take you to the other one that is out there. We can measure it. It's in all the information and it exists, and that's the enormous disparity between the property rich, property poor, or the or the poor income and good income districts. The testimony is it ranges now from 12,000 to
In 91, Beechwood was the highest, excluding the island schools, which everyone agrees are not relevant. Beechwood was the highest at 11,000 plus, and the low end was 3,200. That's correct.
Now, that disparity, you argue, is constitutionally permissible.
We do.
At what level would it be constitutionally impermissible?
Your Honor, I think the only thing the Ohio Constitution does, and I say that it does this happily, is it requires that a minimum floor be provided. Let's consider the two alternatives in terms of dealing with these disparities. Let's ignore the question for the moment whether the Constitution speaks to this. One answer is to say to the good people of Beechwood that they cannot invest as much money as they would like in their children's education. That's obviously not an education first goal. I'm not even sure plans
Well, but they wouldn't have a case if the state wasn't putting any money in, would they?
I'm not sure what you mean by that. Another call, if it was exclusively funded locally?
Right.
Oh, well, you certainly have the same problem. I mean, in view of, I think, in 91, Beechwood got 2,000, so they would raise 9,000 locally. You still have a serious gap. I think the problem is once you recognize that it can't very well cap it, indeed, I think it's entirely inconsistent with our tradition, our culture, the notion that this is not a socialist state. There may be a mixture of socialism and capitalism, but one thing we've never done with respect to such social and economic issues is say you can't spend as much as you want in one area.
But you could cap state effort. You could say to Beechwood.
Absolutely.
$0.
As a legislative matter, that might well be a good decision. I don't see how the Constitution requires it. And if we think about it, it doesn't make sense in the context of this case that people working hard in Beechwood, for one reason or another, have additional money, that we should be telling them, buy a new Mercedes, join another country club, but God forbid, don't invest it in your kids' education.
So there is the constitutional mandate does not prohibit any disparity. We can make it five times the disparity you have today, and it would still be okay.
If Howard Hughes or Jane Paul Getty or the whole crew decided to move to one school district in the state and invest $100,000 per pupil in their kids' education, I don't think there's anything in the Ohio Constitution that prevents it.
So long as the
legislature can prevent it.
So,
as a matter of policy, they may well prevent it.
But your argument is the disparity doesn't matter so long as every child is afforded
a free basic education. Absolutely. And I think that's what Walter recognized, that we've got these competing interests here. On the one hand, we want to ensure, and this is something they wanted to ensure back in the 19th century, we want to ensure that there's a basic, free, adequate education for every school child in the state. But at the same time, we've got this competing interest of allowing citizens
and it's your
freedom of choice.
And it's your position that every child in this state is being provided a free basic education today.
Absolutely.
And that's true even if they're going to school buildings. Do the buildings count, the condition of the buildings?
I don't know how to deal with that.
I've got a whole list of questions for you on that issue, I'd be happy to
talk about that because I agree. I guess I want to make two points.
Is that wrapped in the constitutional text, is what I'm asking?
I'm not sure. Let me explain what the problem is.
Let me just add one more thing, because I believe uncontroverted in the record is the fact that the General Assembly repealed the application of the Ohio Building Code as to school buildings when it became apparent that many school buildings couldn't pass code.
Well, I think that's new school buildings, but yes, that's true.
Okay.
I think there's a couple issues we're wrestling with. One is the issue I pointed out before, that there's a constitutional limit on what the state can do with respect to building. Okay?
I'm interested in this issue because it seems to me that if you look at the record just on the condition of the facilities in which many school children attempt to be educated or are being educated, that one has to wonder whether there is an efficient education occurring in those buildings. As I understand it, I need some help to understand this. I understand that the facilities fund to which you referred, is that, that's the fund to which a school board can apply to help pay back a loan they've received from a bank, right, or from a lender? Is that?
Well, the way it basically works is it's a matching formula that if you raise, for instance, in the case, this case, Southern Louisville and Dawson Bryant both replaced their high school and their elementary school. Their requirement was to raise 20% of the total cost of the building. Then the state matched, well, it was more than matched, provided 80% of the rest. So for Southern Local was $7.9 million, for Dawson Bryant was $10 million for the high school. So it's a matching component at this point.
The state could, you suggested earlier that if the state were to give funds to local district, or well, if a local school needed to be replaced, that we wouldn't want the state to come in and replace it, but the state wouldn't have to determine the design. The state could provide funds, just provide the funds to the local district, could it not?
Well,
it could.
That's true, although again, the Constitution places serious caps on the General Assembly.
Okay, that's I want to get to that issue then. Are the caps to which you're referring, the debt ceiling, is that the general, is the school funds, I assume, come under the general debt ceiling that the state has? Is that
well,
correct?
My understanding is that the Classroom Facilities Act funds, until just 2 years ago, have been exclusively provided out of a two-year budget, not the capital appropriation budget, but the two-year budget, but just set aside several or tens of millions of dollars each two-year period to help deal with this problem.
But they're still subject to the overall debt limit that the state has.
Yeah.
They're not a separate debt limit for schools or some category, I don't think.
No, and that's why Governor Boyer said we need a constitutional amendment to deal with this problem.
So the General Assembly, though, then determines the priorities in the capital budget. You know, does the Supreme Court get a new building, or does a new stadium get support someplace? Or?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to argue that case.
No. Or, the point I'm making is to make it very practical, is to say the General Assembly has to decide within this debt ceiling where the money's going to go. They could easily decide that no stadium here, no whatever, but we're going to give it to schools, right?
Right. I mean, but keep in mind, the reason, $10 billion is not only a round number, it's also an awfully long one. It's more than half of the entire state budget. The notion that...
Well, sure, I mean, the amount... It's not for us to say the amount that should be put in the fund, I don't think, but my point is, I guess, is that if you just look at the facilities, if you assume that the teachers are well paid or adequately paid, and that every student has books and so forth, and then you look at the record on facilities, you have to ask yourself, well, so what? I mean, if there's asbestos, if ceilings falling down, or if the heating plant doesn't work, that's not efficient education, I don't think.
Your Honor, it's unacceptable. I mean, if there's a classroom in the state where there's a leaking pipe or their classes are falling down, we've got to do something about it. I mean, if there is a school district where they're not passing proficiency tests, we've got to do something about it. But the question is, who is going to do it? The will of the voters have risen to the educational challenges of the state at every turn in our history. In 1906, when we had the problem with the sudden urbanization of the state and growing cities that didn't have enough property tax to pay for their kids' education, the General Assembly, not the courts, came to the rescue. After the Great Depression, which was a far greater catastrophe with respect to education than anything we face today, it was not the courts, it was the General Assembly, through the pressures of elected politics and ultimately the will of the voters, that solved that problem. And the same is true with the property tax problem that Justice Sweeney identified. Again, they came up with the most progressive scheme available. But my central point is that the Constitution doesn't make value judgments about this issue. It just doesn't. It doesn't take one policy solution and take it off the table. And if it did, we'd be in real trouble. I don't think what this court wants to do is say that the state is responsible for all school buildings throughout the state, whether they own them or not. If the state is responsible for funding these buildings, once we go down that path, there's no return. What school district in their right mind would pass a $7 levy, if the school district right next to them just got $7 million from the state to do the very same thing. It's an incredibly complicated problem.
But you indicated that's already happening.
Excuse me?
You indicated that's already happening. They are building...
No, but it's a matching. Justice Piper, yeah. What they've done is it's a matching. They said, you've got to do something. And the poor kids in Southern Oklahoma had to wait 12 years. I'm in complete sympathy, not empathy with them. They had to wait from 1980 to 1993 to get their new elementary school. It should have happened quicker. They couldn't pass a levy in 1980, but ultimately they did in the early 90s. And if we say that that approach doesn't work, that that is not a value judgment that the Constitution allows, what we're saying is that the people of Southern Local back in 1980 had an immediate constitutional right for immediate funding for a new building. That may be a good legislative decision to make. We may decide to let the legislature do that, assuming they can comply with other constitutional provisions. But to say that that's the only policy choice that the Constitution permits, I think it's very hard to swallow.
Mr. Sutton, it appears that we're winding down, and I just have two brief questions, and I'll ask them without any response. I'll try.
You mean I don't get to answer?
Questions require a response.
Oh, good.
I didn't want to use the word retort. You could turn that on me, too. You make a very vigorous argument that this case is really about local control versus state control. My first question is, if that's accurate, why, in effect, are 550 districts party plaintiffs in this case out of the 611? My second question is, you're making an argument to Justice Piper about the General Assembly does this and that. My concern is that while the Walter case was pending, Walter was decided in 1979. While the Walter case was pending, the General Assembly passed some new law, put into effect the equal yield formula. Walter was then decided and said, that's okay. And within a year, it was dismantled.
Well,
and we went back to the foundation program. Well, it took 4 years to finally do it, but it started before that.
Sure.
Now, is that something we should take cognizance of?
Let me respond to your last question first. I don't think the elected representatives of the state, whether they are local school board members or statewide representatives, for that matter, the governor, can sit back and say there's a lawsuit and we don't need to do anything about education during the interim. The elective process and the pressures of democracy require legislators to respond not just to what's going on in a 3-4 year trial or the ultimate decision in a particular case. They've got to respond every day. As I indicated earlier, the equal yield formula put in place in 75-76 was precisely the one that plaintiffs saw in Rodriguez. I mean, that's the ultimate good faith gesture by the General Assembly. The fact that they later took away the extra equal yield component, that is from 20 mills to 30 mills, again shows their concern with respect to disparities. I said before, Justice Piper, that disparities are not a constitutional matter as long as you've got a basic floor safety net amount. All right, but it's not to say that as a legislative matter, that what General Assembly shouldn't do just what it did back in the early 80s, which is say, well, you know, the way this extra 10 mills is playing out, it is benefiting the wealthy districts. They're the only ones able to levy 30 mills. So we can disagree as a policy matter whether we should return the equal yield formula. I will say this, it's not going to solve these plaintiffs' problems. That's the heart of their complaint. The heart of their complaint is they can't pass local levies. So it wouldn't solve their problem. Now, this first question that you asked is an entirely relevant one, and that's that we do have to choose about every school district in the state against us. They're not happy. We understand. But the reason they're not happy goes to one fundamental question. It goes to money. They want more, they need more, and they may be right. But the problem the General Assembly has is that's not their only constituent. Every year, they've got to deal with a whole host of factors, including, perhaps most notably, where we are as an economy. Are we in a recession? Are we on the rise? Where are we? The local control issue, and I think this is an important fact to keep in mind, I think what plaintiffs are saying is that when we've got a problem, it is by constitutional mandate the state's responsibility needed, which is to say we need more money right away. And that's an understandable reason for them to file a lawsuit. The thing they're not dealing, the thing they're not addressing, is that they want to retain complete discretion with how to spend that money. As the court in Rodriguez in footnote 109 indicated, it is axiomatic that control and power follow money. There's absolutely no way we're going to have a future school system the plaintiffs win where the state budget for education increases by $1, $3 billion, $10 billion, pick your figure, where the state is not going to take more control over how that money is spent. Keep in mind, it's the state's position that some of these problems have to deal with the fact that local school districts, through the exercise of local control, are spending more money in one area and less in another. There's no reason to think that problem is not going to continue.
Counsel, I think your point there is well taken, and I want to bring you back to something I promise I'd let you talk about with a question, and that's the end of this game if the plaintiffs prevail. And one of the concerns I have is that if they prevail in the end, many of the small school districts might wish they had when they see the solution. But so I want to give you an opportunity to comment on that. But maybe I misunderstand what this case is all about. You indicated that the plaintiffs are basically here because they can't get the local voters to pass levies. And I thought, at least while that may happen in some school districts, that there were a lot of plaintiffs alleging that they have passed levies and that their effort on the part of the local voters in terms of measured by millage has been just as great as some of the wealthy school districts, but because they're so poor from a property standpoint, it doesn't mean anything in terms of the overall cost of it, or it means very little in terms of the overall cost of educating a child. The 10 mils in a poor school district of new taxes, even if the voters support that, just doesn't begin to get the job done. Isn't that really their concern and the heart of the constitutional issue?
Well, clearly, Justice Pfeiffer, the question of the utility of the property tax system for supporting the foundation amount per pupil expenditures is a key policy matter in this case. But the point we've been trying to make is that the foundation formula the General Assembly has adopted can't really be much more progressive. Consider your school district where they are passing levies. They're going beyond 23 mils. And yes, it doesn't give them much more. There's not much more yield. But the only solution to that is to increase the foundation formula, which is to say, continue a matching approach up to 30, 40 mils, which is what we did. 30 mils was, of course, what we did in Walton. That may be a sensible approach. It may be what the voters of the districts you're talking about need, because they are able to pass levies. They are able to get up to 40 mils. It just isn't doing much.
Okay, now if we determine that this constitutional mandate was not being met in 1991 when this case was filed, don't retain jurisdiction, just say that the legislature was not meeting the constitutional charge at that point, which is what I understand the plaintiffs to concede, that's all they're asking. What's the huge downside that you would have us consider?
Well, I'd like to respond to that, and then if I could have a chance to respond to your strict scrutiny point that you were discussing earlier. I think the best way to think about that, of course, I don't know the answer. I don't know at least the broad picture answer of what's really going to happen. But we can look to some other states. Ohio is not the first state to see this type of litigation. Indeed, there are several states that not only seen this litigation, but awarded the very type of relief the plaintiffs are seeking here. That is a judgment that simply says the current educational status quo is unconstitutional. Do something, legislature. Well, we know in California, as some of the briefs indicate, things got worse after that. All they got was Proposition 13, and they've actually moved down the nationwide rankings, whether it comes to output or per pupil expenditure.
Well, they also have a huge migration of people who can't even speak the English language to, that goes into that. I'm not sure California.
Well, I'm not sure I can say that. The only, I do know Proposition 13 was a direct response to that decision. Texas and New Jersey, other big states that have had this litigation, the reason we don't know the answer is they haven't come up with a solution yet. New Jersey's been through this for 20 years.
What about Kentucky?
Kentucky is too recent. It's 1989. And if you look at the 1989 decision, among other things, you'll see that Kentucky was at the bottom of the bottom in virtually every national ranking when it came to education output and spending. That's just not true in Ohio. We're not only in the top half in virtually every category, we're well into the teens in per pupil, total expenditure, state share. New Jersey and Texas are playing legislative ping-pong between the legislature and the court. They've each had 3-4 rounds trying to figure out what this means, and what it requires is what Justice Piper suggested at the outset when we were talking to Mr. Pittner. And that's that in the end, if you're going to say that we're going to monitor this high-quality education from here on, it requires you to roll up your sleeves and get involved in making all these money decisions. And I'm not sure I know how the court can do that. That was what was right about Miller, and that was what was right about Walter. Ultimately, they're saying you've got to provide a basic foundation amount, but there's something else here. We can trust the voters. We can't trust the voters when it comes to education issues. We can't trust them about anything. If there's one thing that people in the state know better than any of us in this courtroom today, it's what's going on with their kid's school, their grandchild's school, or their neighbor's school, because they see it firsthand. They drive by it every day. And it's also true with respect to our statewide leaders. Just like with the other question you raised, is the question of
very quickly, Mr. Sutton.
I'm sorry.
To wrap up.
Well, strict scrutiny is a sword and shield, is all I want to say. And I think in the end, it's not something they'll be grateful they receive. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Pittner, you've used your time, but take 2 minutes. Let's start with 2 minutes and see where we are.
There's just a couple of brief points I want to make to the court. First of all, we're not talking about local dollars and state dollars. All the dollars we're talking about here are raised by the state of Ohio pursuant to state law. The state of Ohio has decided that it will rely to 52% of the funds from the local property tax. That's a legislative decision. There's nothing in the Constitution that says they have to do it that way, or that they have to rely to that extent. Second, let's look at what we've done to local school districts if we're counting on local control. Over 60% of the schools in the state of Ohio today could not raise enough money to fix their facilities needs if they had no other debt and if they indebted themselves to the absolute maximum. They simply couldn't do it. Over $500 million has been forced borrowing by the state of Ohio so it could balance its budget on the back of local school districts, and not $1 has ever been submitted to a popular vote. The state, by law, made them borrow that money. Finally, and most importantly, the people who are the beneficiaries of this system don't vote at all. They're the children. They have no vote, they cannot pass property taxes, and they have no power in the General Assembly of the state of Ohio. In conclusion, Your Honor, I'd like to note that education in our country has been the ladder to the American dream. Education has made our nation the greatest in the world. It's made our state a great shining place. But for many of our children today, the climb up that ladder has been made more difficult. The ladder is steeper and some rungs have been removed. There are many people in this courtroom today who have overcome those obstacles, who have achieved in spite of it. We're not here about them. We are here about the people who will not achieve because of it. And when the climb is made more difficult by the system imposed by the state, then we've done something wrong. We have ignored our obligation under the Constitution. The matter before this court today transcends issues of popular opinion, transcends issues of politics. The state today truly has in its hands, that this court has in its hands, as you decide this case, the future of our state.
state and perhaps our nation, and I would ask that you consider three things, if you would. First of all, consider why those words were there in the first place. What it is that the framers of our Constitution intended. Secondly, consider the plight of our children today. Could the framers possibly have intended such vast disparity and deprivation? And finally, while counsel says consider the cost of remedy, consider the cost of no remedy. Consider the cost of permitting, continuing to permit the General Assembly to grant or deny education to our children with no guidance, with no limitation, save total deprivation, as counsel has said he believes their standard is. That is not acceptable.
Thank you, Mr. Pitcher. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn the court.
All rise.